This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Talking the talk with head, tongue and toe. Walking the walk. Education can be so awkward. Spotlight on Academics We Know.
Katrina Lekong is a trained occupational therapist and principal lecturer at Otago Polytechnic in the Bachelor of Social Service. In 2022, she completed her master's thesis, Wairua Te Atahua Kai Fatu, The Beautiful Weaver, Incorporating Wairua into Tertiary Education. Katrina is currently living abroad for a year in Vietnam with her Kiwanese family, and you can follow her on Instagram. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning.
I'm really excited to be talking to you for the first episode of this podcast. You are one of the first people I met at Otago Polytech because I met you at an interview that you were interviewing me for a job there. And I remember thinking that you were very smiley, although you didn't crack as many jokes as our colleague Jill, who was also interviewing me.
Right.
And then you told me that it was a great place to work with children, that actually having children and having the boss that is there just made it an easy place to work, which I thought was really exciting because I'd never worked in a place like that before.
Yeah.
What do you remember about when we first met?
Yeah, same thing. I remember having the interview at Otago Polytechnic up in our People and Culture area, and you were really enthusiastic and had lots of great information, and you were only a few minutes in and I thought, this is the person.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so nice.
It was easy. You were amazing, and we've definitely proved us right. It's been great.
Thank you. That is good to hear. I'm just finishing my first year, so that's nice to hear. So we could probably start with some of the questions that I actually planned. So Great. Tell me a little bit about who you are. Who are you?
Sure. I'll start with my mihi. That feels like the right place to begin. So ko drum kit in te tūtaka waiwai, e tipu aki au ki marua wai, e raro e te maru o te mauka o Hokonui, e te taha o te awa o Matauda, kei te noho au ki o te poti. Ko Irish te iwi, ko Shields Rato, ko McDonald, ko Rogan, ko Waiba ka whānau, ko Karen Arawa, ko Jeffrey Kamatua, ko Otene, ko Katrina Lekong, toko ikua. So kia ora. My ancestors come from Ireland. That's the part that I know at the moment. And I grew up in Goa, or Maruawai, under the beautiful mauka of Hokonui and the awa of Matauda. And I've been living here in Otipoti since I came to study. Back in 2002 was my first year. Did a Bachelor of Occupational Therapy at Otago Polytech and went out and worked as an occupational therapist, mostly in mental health. Met my wonderful husband who also works in mental health. We've got three gorgeous boys, and I came back to Polytech in about 2015, I think it was, and I've been working as a lecturer. I'm a principal lecturer and program coordinator in the Bachelor of Social Services now. I'm a mum, I'm a wife, I love to play netball.
I was going to say,
very
and
socially,
netball player.
Yeah. And I've just finished my master's in occupational therapy as well.
Okay, well, let's start with what is occupational therapy?
Good question. Well, for me, occupational therapy is all about providing opportunities for people to live a meaningful life. So if you were, let's say, struggling with depression or anxiety, we might look at ways of helping you to manage that, thinking about what are the daily things that bring meaning to your life and helping you get back into those. If you had broken your leg and you weren't able to get to work or play netball, then we might be looking at strategies of how do you strengthen that, how do you get well, how do you get back into those activities. So providing equipment is part of that, which is often the bit that people remember or know about occupational therapy, but obviously it's a lot more than that. And working in mental health has been my main area, so definitely about providing meaning and joy and hope in people's lives.
I was so lucky this year to pick up some of the courses that you planned and teach through that lens and start learning a little bit more about occupational therapy. And I loved that idea that, you know, your occupations are, it's not just your job. It's how you spend your time. It's how you are in the world. Yeah. And I've certainly seen in education the hit people's mental health takes when they can't do what they want to do with their time, when they can't do what they want to do with their bodies, if it's a sports injury or an illness or just whatever. That loss of purpose and meaning is really real and hard to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And so rewarding to be working on that other side of seeing people come through that, seeing people find new hope, wellness, recovery. It's awesome. And how great is it that we get to take that information and train up the next round of support workers to do that work.
I love that in the programs that we work in, we've got all of these people who go, I want to help. Mm. Like, I like people and I know what it's like to suffer and I want to help alleviate that for people. And I love that. I think we work with some really interesting, compassionate, thoughtful people.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely.
So in addition to being a lecturer and an OT and a mom and a netballer, you are also a learner. You're a conga. Mm-hmm. And you like to learn, I assume, because you work in academia and you chose to do a master's. Let's start with, what do you like about learning?
For me, learning is an opportunity for growth. It can be pretty uncomfortable sometimes, and I think about the first coming into academia. I think that's when I probably developed and stretched and grew the most, is coming into this world, into the academic world. I love being challenged, and that's hard sometimes, but being able to look back and go, oh my goodness, there's so many things that I didn't know, or I did, or I thought, and now I know better and hopefully do better.
I love that quote. That's Maya Angelou, isn't it? When we know better, we do better.
Absolutely.
So learning can be really uncomfortable.
Mm.
Tell me about an awkward learning moment you've had.
I was thinking about some of the hard moments, and I think the hardest for me was coming into, first I taught on the certificate in health and wellbeing, training level 4 support workers, and in that course, I was learning while teaching, because that was my first teaching position. And one of the topics that we were teaching the students, that I was sitting in alongside a Māori lecturer, was around the history of Aotearoa New Zealand. And I had that moment where I thought, I didn't know any of this. Mm. And how am I 10 years into practice, done a bachelor's degree, done postgrad study, and I don't know any of this.
Mm, and I've been living this country my whole life.
Yeah.
And we don't know the land we're standing on.
That's it. Exactly. And then I had, and so that became part of my journey of learning and awkwardness and not knowing what to do or what not to do or what space to step into and what space to, that wasn't mine to step into. Mm. So challenging, working through all of that. And fortunately, the Rachel who I was co-teaching with was just such a generous, honest and kind and caring and graceful co-teacher, so was really helpful in helping me work my way through a lot of that. But I remember having another moment later on where I was teaching or working alongside, and we were talking about the health and social determinants and statistics here in New Zealand. And I had that moment where I realised that I wasn't teaching about some other client that my students would be working with. I was teaching about them. They are the ones in that classroom, my Māori students, Pacifica students, who are those health statistics. The fact that they're sitting in our classroom is a miracle. Mm. You know, the fact that they've survived preschool, high school, managed to find their way into tertiary education is
and navigate the discrimination that has existed the whole way through in that educational journey.
Yeah. So that was a tough learning moment. Just having that moment of going, oh my goodness, this is not some other client that these people are working with. These are the people that are in this room. So
that's massive. And I think often academics, we're really good at thinking. We're really good at being in our head and talking about theory. And then you actually have to look and feel the reality.
Yeah.
And that's massive.
Yeah.
The head's so much easier to teach than the heart.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So that was some tough learning. It was good learning. That's the kind of stuff that I look back on and say that was really hard. That took a lot of conversations and thinking and reevaluating and having to let go of a lot of learning that I already had, just impressed as I grew up, and deciding to try and do things differently.
Yeah, it's really difficult because there's not a lot of guidance in how we navigate this space because it's pretty new.
Yeah.
And, oh man, do we get it wrong sometimes?
Yeah.
And who is our safe person or people who can say, actually, you didn't get this right, and I want to help you grow, and I want to help you do better?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to put that burden on my Māori colleagues,
yeah.
but also, who do I ask? Yeah. Where do I get help? What would you recommend for somebody who wants to start that decolonization journey or that anti-racism learning?
I think there's some incredible authors and podcasts and YouTube that I've been engaging in. I listened to an e-book recently over my last holiday break, and it was Why I No Longer Talk to White People, and it was from a black English woman, and it was incredible. And just to listen to the stories and just to try and put my take on that perspective, there is D'Angelo, and she talks a lot about white privilege, and she does it in a way that makes so much sense. She talks about it in terms of women are able to see and feel that sense of being the odd one out in a room full of men. Well, let's talk about it in terms of ethnicity as well. And she does that in such an incredible way. So I think there's an opportunity for us to be able to actually take on board that learning ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then connect with other tangata tiriti partners who are interested in this journey as well, and talk and check out things and be open to be challenged. And I think the other thing that is helpful is to try not take a defensive lens.
Mm.
It's really easy to be challenged from something that you've spent your whole life believing and then being defensive about that. I think that's probably a natural human trait.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to just sit with it and go, let me just sit with this, is super useful in being able to grow.
Yeah, just that moment where you go, well, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe we're all wrong.
Yeah.
And leaving room for that.
Yeah.
You use the term white privilege.
Mm.
How would you define that?
For me, in a practical sense, it is that everything around me is created for my comfort. So my whole life, my teachers looked like me. So if we just begin, even I was thinking the other day about my primary schooling. I went to a primary school. When I walked into the classroom, my teacher probably looked at me with warmth, thought that I looked like one of her children or her grandchildren, that my perfect white blonde piggy tails and uniform matched her perception of a good kid.
Mm-hmm.
When she spoke, the language she spoke was the same language I spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And the values and cultural context, the way that she did her birthdays and her Christmases and her Easter celebrations were the same way my family did birthdays and Christmas and Easter celebrations. So everything around that meant was catered to as much success as possible. So even if I had some difficulties with maybe speech or I had some neurodiversity, I already came in with a foot in the door.
Mm.
And then as that progresses later on, when I went to apply for a job, the person that interviewed me looked like me, spoke like me, same accent, southern, nice, lovely southern accent as me.
Mm-hmm. Rolling those R's.
Rolling those R's. And so everything in that situation was set up for my success.
Mm.
So that, for me, is what I consider white privilege, is that the whole world around me is, and I really like, Peggy McIntosh talks about, she wrote it in 1989, the wearing the invisible, she calls it a rucksack or a knapsack, and down here we call it a backpack.
Yeah.
so wearing that invisible backpack. So when I walk into school, I understand the landscape. It makes sense to me, mm-hmm. and I can follow the rules without having to question anything because it all makes sense.
Yeah.
I walk into hospital and it makes sense. The way they offer the care makes sense to me. That is, it matches my values, and I ask for things in a way that gets what I want because I've learnt the rules. That's been how I've been brought up. I think for me, the biggest learning around that was when I travelled. I haven't travelled extensively, but my husband's from Vietnam, and so we've spent quite a lot of time in Vietnam. And suddenly when I'm at restaurants and shops, I don't know the rules. I didn't know how to navigate that system. And so I was responded to in ways that didn't always make sense to me. And that's when I started to go, oh, right, so my way of doing Christmas and doing birthdays and eating dinner is actually my cultural context. And it is normal for me, and it's normalized where I come from. And when I go somewhere else, it's different. It's not wrong. It's just different.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to see about what that white privilege looks like.
Yeah, and what expectations we put on people from different cultures that we don't even realize we're putting on people.
Yeah. That idea of assimilation is one that I've wrestled with a lot. For so long, I know for myself, I expected people to assimilate to how we do things in New Zealand. Why do you speak that language in public? Why do you push in the lines? Those types of things that I would get annoyed about. And then I realize actually what I'm asking people to do is, so I want you to drop your culture and I want you to pick up mine. And I didn't realize that until my husband. And we were watching one of those I Am Survivor shows, and it was a former refugee from Vietnam who had a very similar story to my husband's. And he said, when I got to New Zealand, I had to decide what parts of my Vietnamese self I left behind and what parts I keep so that I could survive in this new country.
Oh,
and I went, oh my goodness.
God, it's heartbreaking.
That's assimilation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we expect it. We expect other people to do that.
Yeah. And you are in the position of raising children who mm-hmm. are straddling more than one culture and more than one world.
Absolutely.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, though I hadn't really thought a lot about it. And this is, I think, the part of that whole learning journey. I had a moment when I was listening to the ebook from Why I No Longer Talk to White People About Race. And in that, she talked about talking to white women raising black children and the common conversation being, well, I just raised them. But actually, you have to understand that they are walking a very different world where my children don't look Pākehā. They do look Asian. That is just the reality. And so the way that people will preconceive that they are good at maths and they are bad at driving is going to be part of their world. And so I have to prepare them and navigate that stuff. So we have a lot of conversations about people who are outside the box of the standard white hero in New Zealand that are doing amazing things and how sometimes that's really hard and really awkward. So we talk about people like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and lots of women. We read a lot of those rebel stories, goodnight stories for rebel girls, things like that. So they can prepare themselves to understand that those people often have had to go through hard stuff and it's been worth it.
Wow.
They've made amazing changes in the world around them.
How lucky are kids, man? But also how lucky are we to be able to live in a community with you, and I know that my kids will eventually bump shoulders with your kids, and I'm like, these are good people. This is great. So that's quite nice. That's Dunedin, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's and a hopefully, small city.
I mean, I talk about that as though, you know, these saintly children, but, oh, man, they can be testing as well. Ask me yesterday morning.
Yeah, they are
trying
human,
to get them out the door.
We don't have to talk about that.
Yeah.
So in terms of work, what's the mahi that you care about at the moment? What's really sitting with you and resonating with you at the moment?
I think a combination of all of those things. My research was focused on this idea of integrating Wairua or the spiritual aspect of ourselves into tertiary education. And that came originally from an idea of wanting to, I think being an occupational therapist, we're usually very practical, like to do practical things. So if there's a thought about this is what bicultural practice looks like, then I want to say, and you do it like this. Like, I like to get to that point.
So useful.
Yeah. Well, it's for my brain being a kinesthetic learner, being very hands-on, that makes sense to me. I'm like, okay, so that's the theory, but tell me how you do it. That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
So when we were thinking about doing a master's, so I did a co-research with a colleague, Aroha, and we first began having a conversation about talking about bicultural practice because we were co-teaching Te Tiriti together in the certificate. And then she came back and said, well, what I'm really interested in is Wairua. And I thought, actually, that is something that's been sitting with me for a while. So this idea that we are this complete person, and Professor Sir Mason Jury talks, or first introduced that really into the public sphere when he talked about Te Whare Tapawha and the idea that we have all of these and really essential aspects, and we can't just drop one. And for me, that felt like part of my teaching practice. I feel like in order to really engage with my tauira, my students, that I need to bring my whole aspect, my whole life, my whole self to my teaching. And Wairua is a part of that. My spiritual connections is part of that. And so we proposed a master's in looking at Wairua. Went through all the ethics and bits and pieces. Was really interested in an action research, and also about providing autonomy to our tauira participants so that they could be named if they wish. So went through quite an extensive process around consultation and ethics applications, and that was agreed upon. So we ended up with 6 students that we were working with. We met 5 times, and each of those hui, there was a conversation around what do you want to add, remove, modify, or notice in the next session so that you can start to develop your understanding of Wairua. It was the most amazing experience. The tauira involved were passionate and open and honest and just incredible. And we learned so much. And even it's hard not to be impacted yourself in that journey. So, yeah, it was really special. We came up with some recommendations around ways that we can all incorporate Wairua into our teaching practice.
I love that generosity of participants in research, that they want to help further science, and that they want to share their story and be understood. I also find it really interesting that you chose Wairua, because it's not a thing we talk about in academic settings. We talk about the brain all the time. Mm-hmm. We're starting to talk about the heart, thanks to Brené Brown. Yep. Are we talking about spirit or this tingles? I've had it explained to me in a secular way. It's actually Rachel Dibble, who you mentioned, who says it's like that skin tingle you get when you hear great music. Yeah. I was like, that's one fantastic secular definition. How else would you define Wairua, or how did you define it in your master's?
I asked the participants what they were interested in, how they might describe it, and they came up with a whole variety of ways that they experienced it. So that kind of skin tingle feeling that you get when you listen to a great song, they talked about it in terms of their experiences of being involved in kapahaka and haka, and that kind of connection that you have to every sense of yourself and your ancestors. They talked about it in terms of things like connection in sports teams. They talked about it when we did waiata in class, when we did karakia in class. They talked about this connection not only to, say, the waiata that we were engaging in and all singing together, but that it provided a connection to the music, to each other, to their own self, and to their teachers. And even for me, that was so powerful, to be able to think that Wairua is a sense of deep connection to those around us. And man, in this life and in this current craziness of disconnection, how important is that?
That idea of like being able to actually connect on that human level, because we're not going to connect everybody with everybody on an intellectual level or even on a personality level. But if we can actually spend some time together being human and let that experience transcend, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. On that note, what are some of your favorite waiata?
Well, at the moment, I am in a community choir with a group of fantastic people that we get together on a Monday night, run by beautiful Fire Sue Meffin.
What is this choir called?
We are called the Flagstaff Community Choir.
How cute.
Yeah.
Oh, yay.
I think there's about 50 people signed up, but most Mondays we'll probably have 20, 30 people there. And it is awesome. We sing a lot of waiata. And one at the moment is called, I don't actually know what it's called.
Sing us a little bit. Go on.
No. No. I'll pass. But it is a karakia that has also been turned into a waiata, and we sing it, and it is ha ki roto, like take a deep breath, ha ki rato, so breathe it out. And it's absolutely beautiful, and I know that my son's kapa haka group, which is also led by Sue, sing that as a waiata and as a starting karakia in the morning, and it's beautiful. So I've just been introducing that to our team at work at the moment, as a karakia and as a waiata. I love it. It's so beautiful.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. It sounds like music is also a thing of yours, as well as netball and, you know, general good humaning. Why does your work matter to you?
That is a great question. I think for me, knowing that every year we are sending out a group of amazing human beings who are going to change people's lives is really significant. I come from, I would probably say, a long line of people who have experienced difficulties in their mental health. Mm. And I think that's just part, sometimes that's part of the human experience. Mm. But to know that those people that we are working with and sharing our stories and encouraging to dig into their own lives and understandings and experiences so that they can improve other people's lives or walk alongside people at their toughest moments is what gets me up every day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Walking alongside, I mean, there's just nothing more powerful than that, and there's nothing you need more when things get tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think hearing students' stories reminds me very much of the work that I did in mental health, that everybody has a story, mm-hmm. and sometimes they can be pretty tough, and people are incredibly resilient if there's a community or at least a person walking beside them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that investment of another human being is kind of a non-negotiable, really, isn't it? Even for the introverts of the world, we need people.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is it? I'm a rock, I'm an island. Yeah,
yeah.
Not quite.
Not quite.
Not quite. What difficulties, weto, or challenges are currently in your path?
Well, time is always a tricky one in academic settings. We have a finite time with our students. I've just finished teaching a year two health and wellbeing specialty students, and I spend the next couple of weeks, once they're finished, racking my brain of, have I done enough? Have I taught them enough? Mm. Have I encouraged them enough? Have I set them up ready for their third year? That is that kind of constant reflection that happens.
Very strong sense of responsibility you've got there.
Mm. Yeah. They're probably is. Is that misplaced, maybe? I'm not sure.
Well, I think I probably make responsible educator sounds like a good thing to be.
Yeah. What is amazing is that I have an incredible colleague who picks up the third year and works with them. So shout out to you, Heath T.O. You are amazing. And I know that whatever I've left them with this year, they will step into next year with you and be strengthened and challenged and extended in their practice. So I sat in, marked the third year students this year who were presenting their final piece of work, and I could see that every single one of them is ready for this practice and are going to be wonderful supports in people's lives. So,
fantastic. Mm. It's so nice to know that our community is just getting more capable of doing this work well.
Yeah.
It's a nice feeling.
It is. It's nice. And I wish that we had hundreds of students lining up to do this work, because it's so incredibly rewarding and you'll learn just so much about yourself and be challenged and extended, and it's just beautiful work. And so many people do this stuff in their daily lives with their friends and their families. So imagine doing that for a job.
And lots of people do it and it's a strength of theirs, but they don't even see it as useful.
Yeah.
And you think, because it comes so naturally to them, and you think, actually, no, this is the most useful thing we can offer people usually.
Yeah.
An ability to listen, an ability to cheerlead, an ability to walk alongside, especially when things are tough.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It's hard to walk alongside people when things are tough, though.
It is.
It's not always comfortable. And, you know, people are not always nice when they're having a tough time.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that side of the work.
Yeah, I think what people find is that if they've had an experience of supporting someone, it's often been with a friend or a family member. And I think that's the toughest. For me, that's been the toughest.
Yep.
Walking alongside family members when they've had a really tough time and I want to swoop in and rescue them. I want to fix whatever's happening. And that is one of the things that we learn in the Bachelor of Social Services and in the New Zealand Certificate in Health and Wellbeing, is that actually it isn't our job to rescue people. In fact, an empowering way of walk is to walk alongside people and let people have amazing resiliency and strength. And if we just swoop in and rescue them, how can that shine if we just take over and be the one that says, yep, I fixed you? That's not useful.
Yeah, I mean, one, I'd say we can't. Mm. I mean, even if we think we can, we can't. It's a short-term fix, isn't it? It's a Band-Aid.
Absolutely.
Because people have to live their own lives.
Yeah.
So how do we equip ourselves and each other to go face those challenges when we're not alongside?
Yeah. And I think that's the challenge with being a family member, supporting people in this space, is that you are there day and night. You know that history of that person.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to see your loved ones hurting, and you want them to be well or back to being well. Working in the professional sense does help, because there is some more boundaries around that. There's a whole community of staff that you work with. You're never in isolation. There's always other people to talk to, get support from. So it does make that work a little easier, but it's always challenging. People, you know, if you innately love people and love working with people and supporting people, you never want to see anyone suffering, and you always want to see people back to being in a state of flourishing. That languishing state is horrible.
It's awful. Mm. And flourishing, I love that phrase. It's not an easy place to stay.
Mm.
And that's, I think, one of the really misunderstood things about using that word in like sort of pop culture or pop psychology. But that idea that if you're flourishing, it actually requires a lot of resources.
Mm.
We have to be thinking. We have to have people on our side. We have to have challenge.
Yeah.
And we have to have like all the walls of Te Whare Te Papa, like there, as well as being grounded in the whenua.
That's right. And I think it's for me, I think that kind of languishing to flourishing is a continuum. And I'm sure I've seen people talk about that in the past, that we all move along there, and that's actually okay.
Yeah.
It's when we get stuck. If we get stuck in that languishing place, that's really horrible. But it's normal to have ups and downs. And I think sometimes with the way that things like social media is portrayed, a reason I significantly limit my engagement is because of the false sense of flourishing being normal all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are days where I cry because I've had a bad day, and that's actually okay.
Mm-hmm.
I ring a friend, I talk to someone, we work through it. Sometimes it lasts more than a day, and that's okay as well. It's that I move through that continuum again. There is days where I'm elated with joy and feeling great, and it doesn't always stay like that.
No.
That's not my normal.
Always disappointed that it doesn't stick around. I think for me, I completely agree about the cycles of flourishing. And like, I love looking, just you look at the seasons, but I'm seasonal. Like, this is the time of year I'm like, let's do a project, let's start a podcast, let's. And then, as things get colder and darker, I'm like, let's lie in bed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same. My motivation for getting up early, being out in nature, just being a better sense of who I am is absolutely tied to the seasons. We are spending a year in Vietnam next year.
Oh, tell me more about that.
So we had a wonderful scheme at work called 4 for 5. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist currently. where I've signed up for the last 4 years, and so now my fifth year is coming at the end of this year, and we have a year away from work, and they saved my position for me, which is great, and I have a year off. So we've decided to go back to Vietnam, where my husband's from. He hasn't lived in Vietnam since he was 12, so we'll be living with his parents.
Wow.
My two youngest, 9-year-old and 12-year-old, will be going to school, to an international school over there, and we'll spend some time. We're hoping to work with, there's an organization called the New Zealand Vietnam Health Trust. They have a website, and you can sign up for membership, and then you get a regular newsletter, and it's amazing. So we're going to do some, it's set up to teach staff on the ground. So rather than that kind of coming in and rescuing and doing all the work for people, and then you pack up your gear and you fly home again, you actually go in and provide education to the staff that are on the ground. So we're going to be doing that in a mental health hospital. Which is going to be fantastic. So that's just for a bit of the time while we're there. But for me, I'm just super excited at having a whole year of summer, essentially.
Yeah. So do they do seasons? Like, does Vietnam do seasons? Mm. I don't know anything.
They have the rainy season and the hot season.
Oh.
Yeah.
Fun.
Or rain and dry. So the rainy season is still warm. It's still, you know, that sort of 25 degrees.
Wow.
But you get a lot of rain. It can be pretty stormy.
Yeah, I bet. So you are, like, born in Gore.
Yeah.
And you've been living in Dunedin. Mm. How are you going to go with 25 degrees?
Great. I love it.
Yeah.
I don't think I was destined to live in the cold southern part of the world. So, yeah, the hotter the better. And we generally spend air, when we do visit, we go over June, July, which is the peak of the dry season. So it's, you know, 35 degrees. It's beautiful.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
And what are you looking forward to in Vietnam?
Looking forward to learning the language. Mm. Looking forward to developing a much bigger sense of the culture. Mm. Really looking forward to spending time with my mother-in-law and my father-in-law, who we'll be living with, who are just super incredible, beautiful, kind-hearted people. And really looking forward to the boys developing their sense of who they are as Vietnamese or Kiwanese, we like to call them, so Kiwi Vietnamese. So developing their language skills, their understanding of the culture. Mm. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to doing things like writing and reading and the things that are difficult to fit in. So trying to publish parts of my master's as much as I can, which would be ideal. And I love reading, so spending some time reading. They have a siesta every day. That's normal, so we spend a lot of time.
How good.
Yeah,
that's
great.
That is my kind of culture.
Yeah.
I think lying down after a meal and not being out in the midday sun.
Yeah.
Sensible. Very sensible.
Yeah. I think we could learn some things around keeping ourselves well by looking at other cultures. We have this, I guess it's that colonial idea of what we do here is the right way and the best way. But actually, even my experience in Vietnam, families live together. So the parents will work and the grandchildren come home to their grandparents every day.
That is
normal.
So good.
Yeah.
And
so,
probably a lot more affordable than after school care.
Absolutely. And knowing that homework's done, they're fed, they're supervised.
And they've got that loving relationship.
Absolutely. No, there is no rest homes. They don't exist because that's how you look after each other. The eating out for breakfast every morning. Like, hello.
Really?
Who wants to be having cereal when you can go out for breakfast every day? That is normal.
What do you eat for breakfast in Vietnam?
Soup is number one thing. So noodle soup, which is called pho.
Which is basically, I mean, cereal is just cold soup, isn't it?
Yeah. So something healthy and filling in the morning. And food is brought fresh every day at the market if you're at home during the day for lunch. So you're only buying and eating what you need. There is no waste. There's no limp salad sitting in the fridge.
And isn't it true that, like, after vegetables get picked, like, they lose nutrients the longer they're not growing?
Yeah. So these are picked sometime in the morning and you head around to the market at 7 a.m. and collect what you want to buy for lunch. And then the idea of eating communally, having a nap for a couple of hours, like, isn't that all stuff that should be so great for us?
It sounds really good. It sounds like you might turn out to be the healthiest version of yourself.
Let's see.
What if they don't have netball there? Do they not have netball there?
No, netball doesn't exist Vietnam. That's all right. I used to be a football player. I say that. There should be an asterisk at the end of that. I played for 3 years. Very averagely.
Well, that's like more than a lot of people. And you had fun. That's good. That's a good sign.
So football's massive in Vietnam.
The beautiful game.
Yes, the beautiful game. And tennis. And I do like tennis. So there'll be things. There's also gyms. So I don't mind a gym.
You'll be fine.
We'll be fine.
Do they have air conditioning at the gym?
They do, yes.
Oh, that's good.
Yes.
All right. And where in Vietnam are you going to be?
Nha Trang, which is sort of, Ho Chi Minh City's down the bottom, the big city, and it's about an 8-hour drive north of that. And it's, the Vietnam kind of has this, it runs with a bit of a bump out the side. It's pretty much on there. It's a beautiful golden sand beach place.
Mm.
It's like a resort, so we'll be living there.
That sounds great.
Mm.
And as like idyllic as that sounds, you're also having to say goodbye to your life here and close some chapters here to make that happen.
Mm.
What are you currently finding closure on?
That's a good question. I was feeling like everything was fine and I was totally okay with it until I said goodbye to my year ones this year, and I felt myself get really emotional. There's a group that are going to be moving into the specialty I usually teach, and they're just amazing human beings, and I felt a bit sad to be saying goodbye to them, knowing when I come back they'll be third year, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I've been spending quite a bit of time with, I've got two younger sisters and my parents and a bunch of beautiful nieces and nephews, and saying goodbye to them is going to be really hard. So we've been slowly, progressively working towards that, having some kind of farewell things together, spending lots of time together. We'll spend Christmas together and they'll come and see us off at the airport, but that will be the hardest. And my stepson, he's 20, he's building here in Dunedin, he's staying, so we'll miss him. He's coming over to spend some time with us when he's around his 21st, so that'll be great. But yeah, we will miss him. He still lives at home currently, so yeah, we will miss him a lot.
Massive changes for you guys.
Lots of exciting things too though, so yeah. It's good.
Cool. And it sounds like you've got some great work lined up there and you're going to put your skills to good use.
Yeah. Been really nice to be back in that environment. I imagine it'll be really different. And the first thing that we've already talked about is spending as much time with my husband's mum, who is a stunning woman, to try and develop an understanding of the cultural context, because mental health has a cultural context to it.
Absolutely.
So being able to unpack as much as we can, spending as much time with her before we head off to do that, just asking questions, getting to understand where mental health fits in that culture over there, so before we go into the work, so that'll be good.
Oh, that's fascinating. I think that I mean, we're lucky to have you here, but they're gonna be very lucky to have you there too, because you are such a generous and kind and open practitioner. And
thanks.
I've really enjoyed watching your work and working sort of down the hall and hearing about your amazing reputation from your students and colleagues.
Mm.
And it's just been great. Do you have any questions for me? This is just the unrelated question session.
Well, you're having a change in role next year.
I am. I'm taking over your job.
What are you most looking forward to?
Well, now that you've mentioned you've got these amazing first-year students, I'm really looking forward to meeting these second-year students.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm also really looking forward to, and it sounds ridiculous, I'm really looking forward to moving to the big office with the big window, because I'm currently in a very small room, which is fine, and there's lovely people, but there's also teeny tiny windows at the very top.
Yes.
And it was a hard room to be in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
And I used to wander down the hall to the big open office where your desk is and just stand at the window and be like, look, there's trees out there. There's a world. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Awesome.
I'm also looking forward to getting to teach more because I only lectured one day a week. It was a big, long day if I did lecture all day. But that's fun for me, and that's more fun than sitting in front of a computer screen, which is this year that was 4 days a week, so I'm looking forward to that. So thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
It's gonna work fine. Well, thanks for coming out. This has been such a good conversation and a really nice way to say thank you and to honor you as an academic and your huge achievement this year, finishing a master's while working full time and raising a family and everything else that you do. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's really nice to chat about these things, the things that we're passionate about, the things that we're learning. Hopefully people are able to take away some things themselves and, you know, be challenged, try something out. It's good.
Maybe these conversations are useful for more than just us.
Yeah, good.
Hopefully. Awesome. Okay. We'll see you on the other side of Vietnam.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks, Adrian.
Bye.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.